And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Who owns our water? I guess it depends on who you're talking to. Most of us assume we have a right to our water. After all, without it, we die. And yet, around the world, water and rights to water are now the new liquid gold. If you think the world is getting tight over our limited oil supplies, just wait until the water starts drying up. Who does own our water? We consider some amazing dynamics being acted out in our own backyards when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I don't know about you, but late April blizzards seem mighty strange. As we speak, thousands of homes along the northeast coast are flooded. Global weirding, almost everyone agrees, is underway. Today we're going to be touching the rural areas of America as we begin the show with a look at what is being dubbed the new organic. For years, organic was the label of choice for almost everything eaten, grown, or applied. The demand created a huge market for fresh organic produce. It was healthier, tastier, and safer. And it was more expensive. But now, we're beginning to talk about the legitimacy of flying and trucking these fresh organic foods to markets literally around the world. But locally grown foods are getting a serious second look. And you can help make this much more reasonable food source a reality as local becomes the new organic. That's coming up following today's news. In segments 2 and 3, we take a look at a related issue, namely the profusion of bottled waters that are filling whole rows of supermarket shelves and appearing in the hands of almost everyone these days. There's a lot of questions about why those precious bottles of water have become so necessary. But the question takes on a whole new meaning when that tasty water happens to be drawn from your water table. In segments 2 and 3, we take a closer look at a rural area of New Hampshire that is struggling to have a voice in the future of the water that fills their wells, as a water bottling company plans to pump out over 300,000 gallons of water a day from their underground aquifer, bottle it, and ship it over to Italy. The story of USA Springs is a wake-up call for you. It's all coming up following the news. So now, the news. As I speak, the U.S. Senate is continuing its inquiry into the ongoing saga of Attorney General Gonzales, and rumor has it that Dennis Kucinich will be introducing articles of impeachment against Dick Cheney. There's a lot to be said about democracy in action. After a week of strange stories of animals which seem to be fighting back, it almost seems as if Mother Nature is flexing her wings a bit off the east coast of Newfoundland, kicking up onshore winds that is compressing the broken sea ice and trapping 100 seal hunting vessels. The situation is the worst anyone has seen in over 30 years. As the third and largest phase of the controversial Canadian seal hunt draws to an end, seal hunters are hard-pressed to find a way out of this situation. Laden with part of the 270,000 seal bounty, some sailors have abandoned ship. However, most consider this an unthinkable option. Stories keep coming in of the imminent loss of yet another extraordinary species. The Amur leopard is a latest addition to the list of critically endangered species. The extremely beautiful animal, of which there are only 25 to 34 left in the wild, is destined to disappear from the wild unless immediate action is taken to expand the range of this precious leopard. Like so many other species, the Amur leopard is about to become extinct because it cannot compete with the effects of human beings on its way of life. The expansion of farms, towns, and roads have carved up the available habitat into segments that do not promote their hunting way of life. And then there are the success stories which prove the point that we can do the right thing when we need to, and underscores the fact that nature is resilient. If given the chance, it can come back. The Grand Siberian Tiger, which had been hunted down to a mere 40 animals by 1940, has since rebuilt its population to about 600 animals. With ongoing protections, these animals should be able to remain a viable population. In an effort to curb greenhouse gas emissions in urban settings, a battle over the contribution of gas-powered lawnmowers had some boys and men about ready to support their ban and a return to natural yards. But a compromise is being debated, with Dianne Feinstein suggesting that lawnmowers, which reportedly contribute 10% of summertime emissions in some parts of the country, be outfitted with catalytic converters. Opponents of the bill, and especially Kit Bond of Missouri, where Briggs & Stratton is located, cited a variety of reasons why catalytic converters on lawnmowers could be dangerous, including shedding sparks and just plain costing the consumer too much. The regulation, if adopted, would not go into effect until 2011 for riding mowers and 2012 for push mowers. Proponents on both sides vow to keep on pushing ahead. And that's the news. A few reminders. 2 weeks until the weekly Earth Summit brings you the most important 10 minutes on Earth here on the Wild Side News. Plan to be here for the launch on May 3rd. So now to today's first feature. Local is the new organic. What's that mean? One thing that we all share in common is the fact that every single day of our lives, we eat food. There's a very interesting article that's being published in E! The Environment magazine about local is the new organic. And to help us get a handle on this particular topic is the managing editor of E! The Environment magazine, Britta Belli. Welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks for having me.
Local is the new organic. Give us a sense of what the storyline is here.
You know, the first time that consumers really realized they had a choice was when they started to demand organic food and made that choice with their dollars at the grocery store. And the organic segment of the market has been growing ever since, you know, some 20% each year. And that, in turn, has led to a huge growth in the organic industry. And now, suddenly, there's organic food at Walmart. You know, there's organic food everywhere. And so that kind of caused a lot of us to take a step back and say, well, what do we know about this? Now, organic has gotten so big. Do we really know a whole lot about this food and how it's grown? I think people started to look a little deeper and began to say, well, if I really want a handle on how my food is grown, what if I shop locally and get it from local farmers who I can talk to and really get that food when it's fresh and support the local economy at the same time. So it's kind of the next step.
One of the things that I find is so central to this debate, and I raise this question with myself and my friends on a regular basis. I've been associated with progressive lifestyles or alternative lifestyles in one way or another. I'm certainly a strong environmentalist. But I've also watched that morph into some very, very high-end forms. For example, the bottled water craze, which virtually now is almost universal, raises some serious questions about the efficacy of, for example, flying water from France or some other place across the ocean, creating all sorts of carbon dioxide and adding to the disasters of global warming, so that we can put a bottle of water to our mouth and drink, whereas actually the waters that we have in our local community here are probably just fine. And as well, we pay a lot of money for that. Climate change and as well globalization are actually influencing this discussion. Is it really appropriate for us to ship organic goods from one part of the country to the other? To what degree do you think that's beginning to shape this debate?
Most of our food that we see now in the supermarkets is coming from all over the world. And the average produce that we would purchase travels between 1,500 and 2,500 miles to reach us. And so, I mean, I think that's something that we have to start thinking seriously about is this a system that we want to support? It especially becomes a bit bizarre when we have the same produce that could easily be grown in our own communities or be purchased in our own communities, and we're instead buying it from, you know, it's been shipped from South America, it's been shipped from Chile, you know. It is something I think consumers have to begin to think about is sort of the global repercussions of these choices.
Mm-hmm. Your article actually covers a whole series of factors that relate to this topic. Why have we reached this point now? We're importing foods from all over. part of what you cover in your article is what has happened to the American farms, and particularly their need to really minimize the diversity of their crops. Talk about that.
Right. The majority of Midwest farms today are devoted to corn and soybeans, and a lot of our products are that we see, you know, all these kind of packaged foods and processed foods are made with corn syrup and partially hydrogenated corn oil and all this. We've kind of become a corn-based economy here, and instead are importing a lot of our other fresh produce and fruits and vegetables. This model has just become very heavily established, and it's going to be very difficult for us to really change that and to go back to small farming and to support small farms. But I think that's the impetus here, is that it's possible to start choosing local food again and to start supporting small farmers so that that can be a real part of the economy again.
You mentioned an interesting fact, and that is that certainly have added a lot of chicken versus red meats, for example, in an effort to try to move into a somewhat healthier diet. But chicken is pretty much corn. It's
right.
An interesting way of looking at chicken.
Everything has kind of become corn in the sense that this is what we're feeding the animals. In that sense, that the chicken becomes corn because that's all they're eating. That's what the cows are being fed. And because of our subsidies, and we subsidize corn to such a heavy degree, it's become sort of the cheapest product you can have. So that's what all the animals are being fed. And in a sense, that's what's going back into our systems. That chicken ends up with some kind of coating around it. I mean, you know, and that's, all made of corn as well. So I don't think we've realized the extent to which we are eating corn.
That is what's driving the American farmers to produce essentially soybean and corn. That's where the market is right now. But the part of the story that we wish to really move into is the transference of that form, which is primarily a corn and soybean-based market, into a locally grown and diversified marketplace and farming practices. What's happening in that trend line? We've talked about organic, for example. What is happening in terms of locally grown?
Certainly there's more farmers markets today. There's about 4,000 farmers markets estimated across the country, and so that's an exciting trend. And a lot of this is really well documented, where you could go online and type farmers market directory into Google and easily locate your state and what farmers markets are closest to you. And that's a great way to start to get in touch with what's locally in season in your area, who's growing things in your area. And I think consumers might be very surprised to learn that they can purchase a lot of things locally and that they really aren't that more expensive. And they taste a lot better.
Now, you know, and I'm going to make a distinction here because I think some people get a little bit confused. There's a chain called Whole Foods.
Mm-hmm.
And to some degree, there's without denigrating Whole Foods, but I sometimes think that people associate organic with high prices and to that extent, I mean, there's kind of a joke out there that as you plan to go to one of the Whole Foods markets, you better bring your SUV and as well the back end filled with cash because everything costs so much.
Right.
And I'll just leave it at that. And I think there's some truth to that as we get into these kind of Whole Foods and healthier foods, unfortunately, it seems as if we're paying a really steep price for that. But I live in California here.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go to the farmers markets, I'm finding that the prices are competitive and in many cases even better than I would find at my local large store and the Whole Foods markets. So I almost think we might start to change the dialogue from organic, because there's an association with that it's very high priced, perhaps back to Whole Foods.
Well, I mean, I think the reason for the prices is that you're getting things that are being shipped from such a distance, and you're getting things that are out of season, whereas when you're buying from the local farmer and you're getting something that's in season, there's an abundance of it, and it doesn't cost that much,
right,
you know?
Good point.
So, I mean, I think the selection that we sort of demand at the grocery store causes the high prices, because we want to be able to get every type of fruit and vegetable year-round, you know, regardless of whether or not it's in season. So,
and you're also buying directly very often from the people who've planted it and harvested it. In many cases at the farmers markets, it is truly holistic. I'm curious what you're finding in terms of trends, in terms of experiment that perhaps are taking place to support this concept of locally grown.
I mean, I think to take it to the next level so that it's comparable to what's happened with organic, really we have to get the local food into some larger providers, into hospitals and into schools. And that is starting to happen, especially with schools, which is a very exciting movement called the Farm to Cafeteria Movement. It's in over 400 school districts now, and it really varies. I know in New York City, they're serving only New York-grown apples, which is kind of cool in the schools when they're available. And you know, so every school system does it differently. In California, there's many schools, over 100 schools, that have fresh salad bars that are provided by local farmers or local farm cooperatives. So it's, you know, that's really going to start changing things in terms of not only giving the farmers a larger market, but teaching kids to eat healthier and teaching them about how food is grown and what really fresh food tastes like.
I think personally every school in the country should be actively pursuing finding their local growers and talking to them and making business deals with them. But part of the challenge is the fact that the farmer takes a risk in the sense that they have to survive. They've got families and kids and stuff to do. And it may be risky for them to say, well, okay, what you want me to do is you want me to plant a whole diversity of crops and hopefully somehow I will be able to make a living on this. But that is what they need. So there is this transitional phase here where there's a risk. But the more that these types of arrangements can be set up, and that's what you're really promoting in many different respects, that really has to happen.
I mean, one way to really support that farmer year-round, especially in places, you know, where California, you know, you can have like sort of an abundance all year round, but in the East Coast and other places, that's not possible, is through the community-supported agriculture movement. And, you know, they're called CSAs, and what people do is they're almost like shareholders, and they pay a monthly fee, and they get weekly deliveries, maybe at a local drop-off point or sometimes at their homes, of whatever produce is in season. So whether or not the farmer has a great crop or a terrible crop, they've committed to paying them a certain amount each month to keep that farm afloat, which is another growing program and is doing very well.
Now, I grew up in the Midwest in Minnesota and Wisconsin and lived in rural communities at times. My grandmother had an enormous garden. She grew almost everything that she ate, and they raised chickens, and they had pigs. They really lived on that, and they canned a lot. And unfortunately, of course, we've gotten completely away from that.
Yeah.
But also part of this, the local growing initiative is actually probably gardening and growing your own.
Absolutely. And I mean, and that's interesting. You mentioned the idea of canning because that's something that really should come back into favor to some degree, either canning or freezing. You know, there's different ways of preserving food so that you can have it in different seasons, as opposed to buying things out of season. And probably in many cases they taste better and they might be more nutritional for you. I think almost everyone can garden to some degree, whether it's in a little pot in their, you know, back stoop or if they have a little, if they want to share with other members of their community, start a community garden. It doesn't take anywhere near the amount of effort and time commitment that I think people think it does, and it can be very rewarding.
The idea of having a New York or a Cleveland or a Chicago becoming totally reliant on local farmers is a beautiful image, but probably is not going to happen for quite some time. But I would think that smaller communities kind of naturally are doing that anyway. Are there examples where in smaller communities they are surrounded by rural zones where local stores are buying more from the local farmers?
You know, I think that's kind of where the movement needs to go next. I mean, I know about the Farm to Cafeteria program. I know it's happening in schools. But I think as consumers begin to demand more local products in their stores, that could happen as well. But I don't know at the moment, like, has this trend really taken off at any major chains or anything? I don't think it has. It's certainly headed in that direction.
Well, that to me is where it has to begin, because I believe that there are local communities that could really reach out to their local farming community and start to really define the crops available and as well needs, where the consumer can say, well, I'd like locally raised chickens, pork, beef, as well as vegetables. Almost all of that is available locally throughout most of America and could be handled. And I'm hoping that someone out there in a community will hear this and say, you know, that's a good idea. Maybe someone who owns a store in a smaller town. If, for example, in California, we have a lot of markets, food markets, that is kind of a result of all of the growing that's going on here. And, of course, we're fortunate because we have that year-round. But I'm trying to envision a model where this could start to take off and people could really see the value of it.
it does need to be into a larger market. I think the schools are a great place to start. It's happening at college campuses, and once it gets into, say, hospitals, and it gets into, and certainly into larger chains, similar to organic, I think that would really make being a family farmer a viable occupation again.
I think what has to happen is, as well, corporations have to buy into this and start to think about ways in which they can help create healthy foods for their employees, and in the process, empower their local communities economically. And you know what? Everything tastes way better.
Right. Well, and I think that's especially true with things that are local and in season. I think, you know, when you buy a strawberry, even if it's organic, if it's out of season, it's like, it doesn't really have much flavor. The same is true of a tomato. And,
yes.
You know, so organic, it's wonderful and it's better for the environment, of course, and it's, you know, and it's certainly preferable to non-organic. But buying things in season, I think, can give us a sense of, again, being more connected to what we're eating and to where it was grown. And not that everything we eat has to be local, but I just to start thinking about where things come from can make eating, I think, just a more interesting process in itself.
Mm-hmm. So if someone out here is listening, what are some of the ideas that you'd like to promote that they should be thinking about that they can activate in their homes and in their communities?
Certainly to investigate where the local farmers markets are and go try them out, you know, and begin to support people in their own communities, to just go and learn about what is grown in their areas, and when food is in season, and start maybe thinking more creatively about their diets and how they can use those food items as they become available, instead of just sort of buying the same thing week after week all year round.
I'm a creature of habit, and I get into the habit. It's easy to do for years. We just, you go to the local market and you buy your food there, and that's what you do. But every single time that I've gone to taken the time to go to a farmer's market on a Tuesday or a Thursday or a Saturday or a Sunday, it's so fun. There's fresh flowers there and fresh food, and I feel so wonderful walking around with these bags, and I just get the sense that this is really great for me. And then what happens is, and this is just the truth, that next week I feel wonderful every time I eat. It's a terrific experience. So I'm going shopping at my local farmer's market here, of which I'm blessed with many on any particular day, but I'm going to do that. And I'm going to do this for the next couple of weeks, and because it is a matter of habit, too.
Right, it is.
If you just start to go and you say, gosh, this was good, and you go back a second time and a third time, pretty soon that becomes your habit.
Mm-hmm.
And it can easily replace a large portion of what you do, and it changes the way in which you even perceive what you're eating and how you're eating.
Right. One of the people that I spoke to in the article was a woman who runs a blog called eatlocalchallenge.com, and that's a fun thing that people can try. I know in September they're doing another, I think they do it across the country and even around the world, and people go and write their experiences, and they, for a month, commit to eating within a 100-mile radius, all foods within a 100-mile radius. So
that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I like that. Plus, it's fun.
Absolutely, and you're sort of sharing your experiences with other people around the country, and it's, you know, it's just a personal challenge. You may give up halfway through, or, you may just eat half the food that's locally grown, but it's still an interesting way to challenge yourself and to think about food differently.
Another aspect of that is that it may just encourage you to head out, take a little Sunday afternoon drive, which would break up your otherwise hectic, busy life.
Right.
And put you back in touch with the earth in so many different ways. I just took a wonderful drive this last Sunday, and it was, I need to do a lot more of that.
Yeah.
In terms of helping people find the Environment Magazine, where should they go? And also, if you have some other websites that they may find interesting, share those as well.
Sure. Our website is emagazine.com, and certainly they can link to this article and to some of the groups that we've spoken about. There's also, in terms of the Farm to Cafeteria program, a website called foodsecurity.org, which is a great place to go if you want to learn more about those programs or how to start your own program. In terms of farmers markets, really just putting farmers market directory into Google will, you'll find immediately the USDA's website with all the local farmers markets.
Terrific.
A great resource.
We're talking with Britta Belli, who is the managing editor of E! The Environment magazine, about a wonderful story about local is the new organic. It used to be called bioregionalism. I hope that word comes back sometime, because when people start to look at the concept of bioregional lifestyles, that really begins to be where the rubber meets the road. Britta, thanks so much for, first of all, taking the time to write this article and then sharing it here on the Wild Side News.
Thanks for having me.
There are so many great things we can look forward to as we reconnect with our lands and earth and communities. But sometimes good people find themselves having to take a stand for themselves, their families, and friends. That certainly is the case in New Hampshire. We take a look at the USA Springs controversy when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As we head into hurricane season, thoughts about Katrina return. And one of the most painful sights were the thousands of people trapped outside the New Orleans sports arena pleading for water. It finally came in pallets of bottled water. A day without water is rough. But some communities in America are fighting to keep the water that has been theirs for decades, as a foreign designer bottled water company starts shipping our waters overseas. Welcome to the New World Order. Stay tuned. As the story about global warming heats up, one of the things that people are beginning to talk about is the fact that water in the future is going to become a very huge issue. Communities that rely, for example, on glacial melt, which actually are many, many communities throughout North America and the world, rely on glacial melt, which is supposed to come off at a regular rate, and we've set up our entire communities based on that. But as global warming increases, that rate of melt may increase, and therefore at the end of a season, we may not have any water left. These are very serious issues. Some people are even beginning to talk about the future being an era of water wars, where this issue becomes such an enormous consideration in the future that people begin to literally war as we are over oil issues. Water may be the new oil. Very serious considerations. And that's why there's a story that's coming out of Nottingham, New Hampshire, small town in New Hampshire, that really, I think, directly speaks to this. And joining us now to learn a lot more about this issue of water and small towns is Bill McCann, who's joining us now from Nottingham. Bill, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Bill, tell me about your relationship to Save Our Groundwater.
I'm a member of the board of directors of Save Our Groundwater, and I'm also chairperson of the Legislative and Governmental Affairs Committee.
Okay, Save Our Groundwater is a grassroots organization that was formed in response to the emergence of a new business that's trying to get started in your community. Why don't you tell us about the company? The company I'll mention is USA Springs, and they intend to put in a water plant. Let's give a little history on that.
Well, they started their process back in 2001, and they have applied for a permit from the state of New Hampshire to withdraw over 400,000 gallons of water per day. During the permitting process, they were required to do a pump test, and as a result of that pump test, There was some contamination that became apparent on site, and the state basically and USA Springs together decided that instead of withdrawing 400,000 gallons, they'd withdraw about 310,000 gallons of water a day. And so that was what the permit was put in for in the spring of 2003. Initially, the permit was denied by our Office of Environmental Services for about 20 reasons, which I would call basically science-based. So, you know, I think a lot of us thought, well, good, this is the end of it. But, you know, they appealed, which was their right. They were ultimately turned down a second time in December of 2003, and then they immediately applied for a new permit, and this time the permit was agreed to in July of 2004. And then since that time, Nottingham, Barrington, and Save Our Groundwater have filed various appeals to try to get the permit overturned.
What is the ultimate endpoint for this water that they're withdrawing? It's a lot of water. What are they going to use it for?
Their business plan indicates that they're going to withdraw the water and bottle it and then sell it overseas.
So you're talking about a bottled water company.
Right. Their plan that they submitted to the town of Nottingham for their bottling plant would indicate that they would be bottling somewhere in the vicinity of 500,000 to 1 million gallons of water a day, which makes us think they're going to try to bring in more water other than what was in this permit that was approved in 2004.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the source of that water, they kind of say 310,000 gallons. Where are they going to get that water?
They have drilled three wells, which would be the source of the water. They'd be withdrawing it from a bedrock aquifer underneath, and that is the major concern that a lot of the abutters and people in the area have, is that both Barrington and Nottingham rely totally on wells for, you know, individual homes' drinking water. There's no public water supply in either of those communities. So currently, residents have their own wells, and the big concern is if suddenly you put in this large series of wells that are withdrawing over 300,000 gallons, which is 112 million gallons a year, what's going to happen to people's water?
You know, it's interesting because a lot of people in the United States think people no longer live off of wells, but quite the opposite is true. Many people do, because I've also had to live off of a well. There's a lot involved. You have to drill the well. I don't know how far you guys go, and we'll talk about that. It costs a lot of money. You drill down to a point where you think, okay, there's a fairly stable water table. It's probably going to be there for 50 or 100 years, and that's where you stake your claim, and then you rely on that water for everything you do. I think a lot of the residents there are just plain afraid that their wells could go dry or become very diminished.
I think that's a fair way of assessing it, because when you look at the information that was gathered as part of the permitting process, some people's wells only go down 20 feet and they've got their water and, you know, they've got their drinking water and their potable water for their house, and they're all set. But this well is going down hundreds of feet. And, you know, the analogy a lot of people have used is the large straw going into the ground. The one that goes the deepest pulls out the water.
Then, of course, the challenge is, then you have to go into the science, the science of legalities, or the legalities of science, or something like that,
right,
trying to prove somehow that their plan will not affect your water. But, you know, those things take many times many years to manifest. I mean, many years meaning 5 or 6 or 10, at which point they're already in business. And at that point, you have a real tough time trying to make changes because they have a huge foothold.
Yeah, one of the things we're doing, and we encourage people to do going back 3 or 4 years, was for people to have their wells tested and get a baseline. So in the event they actually do start production, there is some basis on which if somebody's well suddenly goes dry, is at least some evidence to show that, you know, up until this happened, there was water. One of the other concerns that we've raised and was in our appeal was the fact that in New Hampshire, we have the doctrine of reasonable use in how much water you can withdraw. And the reasonable use is basically to make sure you don't impact your neighbor in a harmful manner. And using that, this was part of the basis of our appeal when we appealed the process back in 04 and 05. But, it's based on common law, and when our case went to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said they didn't really want to get into the common law, and so they did not make a ruling on that particular aspect.
I think it's quite astonishing. One of the great challenges that we have is where, and I'm not trying to be too political here, but I think these are issues that need to be addressed at some point. Corporations have the same rights as individuals these days. So part of the challenge is the fact that this corporation comes in and has the same right as an individual, and their claim is, well, we own 100 acres, therefore we can get some water. But the amount of water that they're taking out transcends anything that any individuals could possibly use, and there seems to be a terrific injustice there.
That's one area that, we became involved, aware of, because, as I mentioned, in August of 2003, when DES denied the permit initially, USA Springs, Inc. filed an appeal. As I say, that was their right. But in reading their appeal, they talked about their first, or, their Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, and they were saying that if the state denied them the right to withdraw the water, it was violating their rights under the Fifth Amendment, an unjust taking. And, that was the first time we really saw in black and white this corporate issue that you mentioned. And it is a concern because they are going to take far more water than any individual living in Nottingham or Barrington, or for that matter in the whole southeast region of the state. So it's an issue where, the so-called corporate personhood and the rights of individuals have really come to clash.
They have. And one of the things that the story is so amazing is the fact that they're not having to pay any extra fees for taking this amount of water from the aquifer. That is astonishing to me.
It's because basically under the common law right of reasonable use, the assumption was that someone would be taking water out of their own land, which would be the basis of, at one point, the courts back in the 1860s said, enough to cover the land with several inches of water was reasonable. And that as long as it didn't impact your neighbors, you could take as much water as you want. And that's basically, what they're saying is, well, we've got 100 acres, we could cover it with, the amount of water coming out. We're not in violation of that. And as I say, the court never really ruled on that particular common law aspect. But, in New Hampshire, we've talked about having some sort of a fee for taking water out of the ground. But the real problem there is you're commodifying water. And, basically, I think water is a human right. We can't exist without it. So I don't think you want to necessarily say that water is a commodity that can be taxed or, so then you'd be basically whoever's got the most money is going to have the most water.
Well, that is what's happening all over the world right now. Water rights are being, that is another side of this story as well that is absolutely frightening, that people are buying up corporations. I don't mean to pick on corporations because there's great corporations, but corporations are actually people. But we'll say corporations are buying up water rights all over the world, and in many cases, people don't even know that that's happening. And a time may come when you no longer have the right to your water, and therefore you're going to have to buy it from someone, and I think we're heading in a direction that is anti-human.
Yeah, I think we're seeing it here in New England because, for instance, a good example is Nestle Corporation has bought rights to various companies. Poland Spring Water in Maine has, been around for years. Well, now it's owned by Nestle, and they are trying to drill more wells in the western part of Maine, and they're actually looking over the border into New Hampshire. It's something we're seeing.
It's interesting because I lived in New Mexico where water rights were owned. You were very limited. You had to buy water rights with your property, and you could as well sell water rights. So, and it depends on where you go in terms of how the law factors plays out. This has gotten kind of nasty. From what I understand, you've been at this now since about 2001 with USA Springs. Now, they're in the process now of trying to get the permit to build the plant, which is a 176,000-square-foot plant. And you're as well trying to figure out ways to at least stall that while you go through the court processes. And at this point, you're kind of in war over a driveway, because unless there's a driveway permit, and this is how the law, this is how these things get fought out, but unless there's a driveway permit, they cannot build that plant. But that issue over the driveway has taken a very personal turn. You personally have been affected by that recently.
Yeah, I mean, we have been arguing that, you know, in addition to the issues concerning the water, from my own point of view, when I saw the driveway permit plan, I was somewhat horrified. And then when I read the Nottingham chief of police wrote a letter to our Department of Transportation saying that there were some major concerns that had to be addressed, you know, and he was willing to sit down with all parties to try to address them. And, you know, USA Springs took the attitude, well, his comments aren't relevant. You know, we pursued that, and then in the last few weeks, several of us got letters from one of their attorneys basically saying that, you know, what we're doing may be an actionable situation and we could be sued by USA Springs for, you know, having an impact on their revenues and profits.
And, of course, I heard a summary of that letter, and it actually mentions both civil and criminal action. When you're threatened with a criminal action, something happens. One becomes emotionally impacted by that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what anything that we have done, any of us that have been involved in this, because it could be considered criminal, and I don't see where anything that we've done really is a civil action, because we're basically using our right of free speech to take them to the appropriate agencies and request hearings and put the burden on them to prove that they're not going to have a negative impact, whether on the environment or in the case of the driveway. I mean, it's a safety issue. When chief of police was quoted in Foster's back at our local newspaper back last July as calling the design on Route 4 a death trap. I think that as citizens, we have the right to say, wait a minute, state government, before you do this, at least take a look at it. And if there is things that need to be corrected or, you know, fixed, make sure it's done before you issue this permit.
I couldn't agree more. In terms of the larger community there, to what degree is this an issue that is on the minds of local residents there?
It's a it's on the minds of a lot of people in the community because as time's gone on, people have become involved. I mean, it's cost the communities several hundred thousand dollars in legal fees to fight this, and the communities have appropriated that money at their annual town meeting. I mean, it shows that the people who are going to be the most directly affected are stepping up and doing what they need to do. And what is actually, I think, very rewarding is communities surrounding have expressed support, have had people become involved, and, you know, it's really a regional issue, and people are starting to see this now. I mean, when you think about it, a lot of the communities that have public water supplies, they're relying on wells that are in the same aquifer as, or are affected by the aquifer as the USA Springs development. So people are becoming more aware of the issue, but the people in Nottingham and Barrington, you know, they've been in the forefront at their town meetings. They've acted, and, you know, it's democracy in action.
Yes. Where do you expect this to go in the months ahead?
Well, I think today, actually, we're going to be having a hearing before the Department of Transportation Appeals Board to try to get standing for Save Our Groundwater. We were denied that by a hearings officer last February, and we're hopeful that we'll get, you know, eventually get standing to be able to present the arguments on the safety issues to the Department of Transportation and bring in the Nottingham Chief of Police to express his concerns on the record and get DOT to take a look at the design of this driveway, which is actually, it's more than a driveway. It's going to be an entrance to a bottling plant. and hopefully, you know, work on that issue. And it's, you know, that's something that is going to take time, and it's a requirement of their groundwater permit. They've got to be able to meet all the requirements of the bottling plant before they can start pumping water.
Do you know, and it's interesting because as I was thinking about this, one of the things that bothers me a little bit is sometimes when we refer to corporations, we're talking about, for example, USA Springs, and we think of it as a corporation. And so now you have, in essence, a corporation through their attorney who is now literally delivering via private detectives these letters threatening, well, I won't call them threatening letters, but they're letters that could have an intimidating effect in terms of back off, or we may file civil and criminal charges against you. But so therefore it's a nameless corporation, it's a humanless corporation. Let me rephrase that. There's no human name it's associated. We don't know oftentimes with corporations who the people are that are involved, but you are involved. Your name is in the paper, as well as people in your organization, so you end up being intimidated personally. You know, your names are on the line. Do you know who really owns USA Springs?
The only name we know is the person who is listed as the president of the corporation, who's a Francesco Rotondo. Every other name that is on the papers are attorneys that we are familiar with. So the only name of a person is Mr. Rotondo, who apparently lives in Pelham, New Hampshire, and this is a closed corporation, so there's very little information that's available.
Well, you know, Mr. Rotondo, if you're listening, perhaps you should visit the community and really meet with the people there, and perhaps you might have a different perspective on this, because obviously if this were happening in something similar that had an impact in your neighborhood and on your family and your friends and your neighbors, perhaps you'd be one of the activists who'd be out there in a very similar way to Bill McCann, who is with Save Our Groundwater in Nottingham, New Hampshire. Bill, if people want to learn more about you or to offer help and assistance, perhaps as attorneys or water experts who would like to step up and offer you some guidance and help or even financial aid, what's the best way for them to contact you?
Well, the best way would probably be to go to the www.saveourgroundwater.org, which is the Save Our Groundwater website, and there's contact information there. And we are obviously looking for donations, looking for help. We're a group of citizens that, you know, live in the region, and, you know, we're doing the best we can, but, you know, getting people who could provide some technical assistance. We've had lawyers who've given us some help pro bono. Our Supreme Court case was done by Joshua Gordon. Pro bono was a lawyer out of Concord. It is a big process because we're dealing, you know, the community has spent, as I say, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Mr. Rotondo claims that his company has spent $1 million in this process so far. So it's not something that's inexpensive. Their actions obviously have a chilling effect on some people. I've been told that we've had a couple of people who have kind of withdrawn now because of the letters. And, you know, this could happen, and it may reduce the number of volunteers we have who can work on this because, as I say, it is a chilling effect when you're told that your actions, if you don't cease, could result in civil or criminal legal proceedings.
Well, Bill McCann, I want to thank you so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News. We're going to continue this story in the next segment as we go and actually talk with a local resident who has property abutting the land owned by USA Springs. Bill McCann, I want to thank you so much.
I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to come on and talk about it.
We'll keep in touch.
Okay, thank you.
This struggle against the USA Springs Water Company takes a particularly personal turn as we next talk with a 78-year-old honored citizen who is now fighting to keep her water on her land. That's coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The issue of who owns our water continues as we visit with a longtime resident of Barrington, New Hampshire, 78-year-old Patricia Newhall, who raised the family on food they produced and grew on their own farm. But now, Mrs. Newhall finds herself entangled in this war over water, and it's getting way too personal. USA Springs just delivered letters from their attorney warning residents not to continue their battle, or civil and criminal charges may be filed. Now there's an image. Patricia Newhall serving time for standing up for the rights to her water. Who owns our water anyway? Now we continue the story about the Nottingham, New Hampshire community and its struggle to save their aquifer, their source of water. This is a community that many of its residents, probably the majority of residents, rely on wells, deep water wells or even shallow wells for their water. And unfortunately, they are the potential for their wells to be impacted in many different ways, both in terms of the water table lowering and or to be contaminated, is what is driving them to unite in two groups, Save Our Groundwater and Neighborhood Guardians. And this is all directed towards a company that is drilling the wells, wants to take out over 300,000 gallons of water a day to turn into bottles and ship over to Italy, from what we understand. So now we're going to talk to a person. Her land abuts the land that USA Springs owns. And so I'd like to welcome to the Wild Side News right now Patricia Newhall from Nottingham. Patricia, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. Actually, I'm in Barrington.
Oh, okay. Barrington.
Yeah, I'm in Barrington.
Okay, fair enough. Well, okay, Barrington and Nottingham, literally two communities.
Yes.
Okay.
Because the land they bought is in both communities.
Ah, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
First of all, let's talk a little bit about you. How is it that you find yourself in Barrington? What brings you to your plot of land there?
Well, we lived on a farm in Newburyport, and my husband was looking for a farm in New Hampshire because there was no future in Newburyport for farming. And we found a 100-acre farm in Barrington for sale for $6,900.
Oh, boy.
And this was in 1960. And so we managed to be able to buy it, and we moved here in March of 1960 with 3 feet of snow on the ground. And we did farm it for the first several years, I would say probably 10 years. And then my husband, of course, had to work off. He worked for Brackett and Shaw Machinery Company. And the girls grew up and outgrew 4-H, and so we got rid of the animals and so forth. And we had a big garden. And I made homemade bread and this sort of thing and raised our girls.
That's a great life. In terms of the farming, what was the nature of your farm?
Well, we raised our own beef and our own pork. We sold our milk and had a big garden selling vegetables from that. And I made bread, which I had a sign out, homemade bread, and sold a lot of that. And we had a horse, and the girls were in 4-H. And then they got to be into middle school and high school and didn't want to go into the barn.
Yeah, well, I've been in barns. I know what that's like. And actually, it's many, many things. It's can be a wonderful way of life, truly.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the community there, is it considered sort of a rural and farming community?
It's a rural community, yes. And there are some farms that are small family farms that are still in existence, and there's quite a lot of land people own. Like we had our 96 acres, and
we wanted to preserve all of our forest land in conservation easement. And my two girls, my husband died in 99, and my girls agreed with me that we should do this. And it took 2 years, but we did put our 80-acre forest into a conservation easement so it can never be built on.
Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, it's a very diverse, wonderful natural area.
Yes, yes.
You've got a pond and
there's a 3-acre beaver pond. It has heron nests in some of the dead trees, and there's a lot of wildlife that's down there in the woods in that 80 acres, including a bear that we saw once, and I know there's fishers and all other kinds.
So you really live and feel your relationship to that land. You
absolutely
understand it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think some people who haven't had that experience don't quite know how you can really sense the land. There's some things you can't really explain scientifically, but you have a sense about it. And one of your big concerns, because now your property abuts the USA Springs property. Now, is there a contiguous, approximately 100 acres, or is that broken up that they own?
No, the 100 acres they own is contiguous.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that 100 acres it's the two towns, but the 100-acre lot is one solid lot. And part of the land that is in that 100 acres is Barrington Wetlands that they bought.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I come in as an abutter, because my land extends to their wetlands.
Their plans are to put up a 176,000 square foot plant to bottle the water. Will they be affecting the natural environment, in other words, the wetlands or the forest? Will that have to be removed to some extent to allow the plant to go in?
Well, because the plant is not built yet. What they're working on now is a driveway from Route 4. But they have changed the placement of the building on that lot to the further end up Route 4, further towards Concord, because they had it situated right behind a housing development called Lincoln Drive. And there were 15 homes. There are 15 homes in there. And their building was to be right directly in back of their property. And because of the Nottingham Planning Board and all the ramifications of adjoining the wetlands, et cetera, they did agree to move the plant to the other end of their lot. So it is further away, and they have conceded, whether they will or not, they have said that they will build a couple of ponds that will protect what wildlife is there. I know they came in 2001, and they disturbed some of the Barrington wetlands with no permit, no anything. Nobody knew they were there. And they had gone in and disturbed the wetlands on the Barrington end of their 100 acres.
Was this for a test drill site?
I'm not sure whether it was for testing or whether they wanted to have the road go through there to wherever they were going to put the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And when that was discovered, DES fined them and told them that they had to repair those wetlands and complete the restoration, which they have never done.
Yes.
They did a little bit of work, but they have never restored the wetlands that they disturbed back in 2001 illegally, which is one reason we have fought them, because they are not a good neighbor.
This is where it gets to be a problem. If you have a neighbor who doesn't want to listen and pay attention to you, you have a bad neighbor. And there's good neighbors and there's bad neighbors.
Right.
And it gets very personal.
Right.
And I know for myself, I can say I've got some good neighbors and some bad neighbors. Good neighbors mean that when there's an issue, you talk, and people make every effort in the world to live together as good neighbors.
Yeah.
And then there are the other kind. Well, let's talk about how this is really affecting you personally and as well your family, because I know that your family has become very personally involved in this.
Well, I have, my well is 13 feet deep. It was doused by a man from Somersworth who had an apple tree branch, and he doused for water, and he found it, and he dug down with his backhoe 13 feet and that's as far as he could go because there were three springs that ran into that hole.
Wow.
And so that's where the well is, and it has never gone dry in the 47 years we've been here.
Hmm. Did he hit bedrock then at that point, or what?
No. This is a sand and gravel. It's the sand and gravel level of water. And this is one thing that people have such a hard time realizing, that there are two levels of water. We have the surface water, which is renewed by rain and snow. And then we have the deep bedrock aquifers, which are way below. And those take a lot longer to recharge. And nobody knows how much water comes in and goes out through the fractured bedrock. And this is the danger that we perceive, that when they draw water out of that deep bedrock aquifer, it will not recharge at the rate that sand and gravel aquifers recharge. And when the level of that aquifer goes down, it is going to draw from the sand and gravel aquifer levels plus the streams and the wetlands to refill. And that is going to lower the water table all over our area, all over the seacoast.
Well, now, it seems if a neighbor wanted to do something like that, and it does have that potential threat for sure, that's certainly been well documented, that if you take large amounts of water, and by the way, I did a little calculation, and just to give people an idea, the estimate is 310,000 gallons of water a day.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I did a calculation, and what that would mean is it would be an entire football field of water to a foot in depth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's a lot. If you get a garden hose and imagine how long it would take,
absolutely.
You know, or run your tap and try to figure out how long it would take to fill up a football field to a foot of foot deep of water.
Right.
You're talking about a lot of water every day. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's really two concerns. One is that the water table itself could become diminished, but as well there's another aspect which I'm pretty sure you're aware of, and that is that as you start to quickly draw down the aquifers, it starts to what otherwise would be the earth itself is the filter that cleans that water and makes it drinkable. You start literally pulling those contaminants down into that aquifer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about those concerns.
And that's what happened in 2002 when they did their 11-day pump test. That was the first requirement that they had to do, was to do an 11-day pump test to prove that they were not going to affect the wetlands and the rivers and the other sand and gravel level waters. And they did the pump test, and the testing proved that there were contaminants from an adjoining lot to their property that was contaminated with man-made contaminants, and those contaminants were drawn down into the aquifer itself, as well as I think there were two wells surrounding the area plus two of their own wells that became contaminated from the contaminants that were drawn down from that property. That is one reason that the DES denied their permit in 2003. And there were 27 scientific facts as to why they were denying this permit. And then the government in New Hampshire changed, and The incoming governor appointed a man as commissioner of DES, and pressure was put upon DES to grant a conditional permit to USA Springs if they cleaned up the contaminants. So they promptly bought the lot that was next to theirs that was the contamination, and in 6 months reported to DES that they had completely cleared up the contaminants in the land and in the water.
But the science hadn't changed. I mean, in other words, okay, so they cleaned up the contaminants, but once they start this thing, it would start the whole process over. One has to question why the permit was okayed.
Because one of the heads of DES said at a meeting that we were at and that I was at, and I heard him say this, that pressure from on high has decreed that they grant USA Springs a conditional permit, thereby saving New Hampshire $1 million to clean up that site, because USA Springs told DES, if we don't get a permit, we will not clean up that site. And they said that in exact words. I was there and I heard it. And Tony Gunta, who was in charge of this meeting and this hearing that we were at, said that pressure from on high, meaning the Governor Benson, put pressure on DES to grant this company a conditional permit.
Well, and then since that time, you've been in and out of the courts. And one of the interesting things about this case is the fact that those of you in these organizations are trying to establish your right as citizens.
Yes.
That jurisdiction allows you to make these cases, and that itself has been an issue.
Mm-hmm. Right, because every department in Concord has denied that we have standing as a registered grassroots organization. And they say we have no standing, therefore anything we say or do or try to do has no bearing on the whole case.
And therefore it can't get into the courts. You have no power to get these things into the courts.
Well, we did go to the state Superior Court, and yes, we did go to the New Hampshire Supreme Court.
Right.
And they declared that the wording of the laws regarding our water were not specific enough to deny USA Springs their permit. And the Supreme Court judges said, if you don't like our decision, then get the legislators to rewrite the laws. And so that is one of the aspects that we have been working on, is to get our representatives and senators to make the laws that we have now more definitive, so that there can be no arguments as to whether the people have a right to say, no, don't take our water.
I get emotional hearing this. You've shared with me your age. Is that something that we can discuss on air?
Well, yeah, I'm 78.
Okay, 78, and
I'll be 79 in October.
Part of the real story here is the fact that here is a person who's lived tried to live a good life, and
mm-hmm.
I've
been very active in my community. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was voted Citizen of the Year.
Wow.
1 year and Volunteer of the Year 1 year.
You don't sound like a really dangerous and intimidating person. As a matter of fact, you sound like a pretty reasonable neighbor. But it's really too bad that a person like you, who literally has their land right next to this
mm-hmm.
Site, is being told that you have no significance in terms of raising issues. I don't understand that. This is supposed to be a democracy.
Right.
And I just don't understand why citizens suddenly find themselves totally disenfranchised in raising questions that they have the right to ask. And there are systems, legal systems set up to protections that are supposed to be in place, and they're just being sidestepped.
Right. We have, we did have a hearing, or a pre-hearing, with the Department of Transportation about the safety on Route 4 with these 60 trucks going in and out every day for 6 days a week. Mm. And they said the attorney from the Department of Justice was there at this pre-hearing, and he said, we have no right to bring any of this to the attention of the Department of Justice, because we have no standing, and therefore we have no rights. And we were supposed to have a hearing with the DOT, and she sent back a letter that said that we had no standing. I understand now that we have been granted a hearing with the Department of Transportation, I think this month, but every department has maintained that we have no standing, and this is one of the things that we, in fact, we asked Governor Lynch to start an ethics investigation, because the people of our state pay our state departments their salaries, and they're supposed to be there for the people, and we have been stonewalled from the beginning by the departments in Concord as to our needs and our desires and our concerns, and mostly our concerns.
What are they suggesting that you're supposed to do when these kinds of threats are occurring? What are they suggesting is your remedy?
They haven't suggested a remedy.
I don't understand that, and it's absolutely totally wrong.
They just figure, well, we're of no account, and they've got the permit, they've got the driveway permit, they've got the everything, and they're going to go ahead and build it.
Right. You've lived there for 47 years. You have accolades about your citizenship, and you're insignificant. That's absolutely wrong. This is progressing. You're trying to follow certain legal courses, for example, trying to get the driveway stopped, because if you get the driveway stopped based on the traffic and other dangers. But this has gotten very personal and has affected your family directly. To whatever degree you wish to share that, I think it would be interesting, because there is, I'm not going to say it's intimidation, but I will say that the effect is intimidation.
Yeah, well, and the letter that was delivered to our board members was deliberately intimidation. The possibility of their creating a slap suit against us is real.
Right, and it's criminal. It's both civil and criminal. But you also had a personal incident. To whatever degree you wish to share that, do you want to talk about that?
One instance that I encountered. A friend and I, we were driving down Route 4, and we had to wait for traffic so we could turn around and come back. And we stopped in the driveway of this contaminated site that they had bought. When traffic went by, we continued on up into Northwood so we could turn around and come back. And this truck pulled out of that driveway and followed us up to where we turned around. He turned around in the same place, followed us all the way back down Route 4 to Freeman Hall Road, which is in Nottingham, and it's almost directly across from their lot. And he followed us. We turned into Freeman Hall Road, and he followed us through there. And so we were scared. We knew that it was the security guard for USA Springs, and we had no idea why he was following us or what he was going to do. And we continued on to the Nottingham police station and got out, and he turned around and left. And we got out, and we went in to talk to the Nottingham police, and he came out, and he said, oh, yes, I know who that is. He's the security guard that was hired by USA Springs, and he does get over ambitious sometimes.
Well, that's not fair.
No, it isn't.
I mean, we're talking about citizens here who are just trying to live their lives. You have everything right in your life, as far as I know. I don't know all your details, but
right.
I have to assume you're a pretty straight arrow, and you're also a woman who's an elder, and to have people, brutes of sorts, intimidating people with trucks.
Mm-hmm.
I find that incomprehensible.
Well, I mentioned before Lincoln Drive, which is there's 15 houses in there, and 10 of those people who own 10 of those houses have sold their houses and moved because of this USA Springs company. Some of the women who lived in there always loved to walk in the woods right behind their house with their children. And there was one woman who was in there walking, and this guy with a gun on his hip approached to her and said, what are you doing here? You've got no right on this property, and scared her. And there were other cases of intimidation. Now, whether he went beyond his scope, we don't know, but he was intimidating the people who lived there on Lincoln Drive.
The problem is the fact that these in so many cases like that, for some reason, they get a pass. No one ever really gets on their case and says, you've really gone over the line here. It seems as if, because it's sort of a corporation and we can't put, they're almost nameless individuals.
Right.
And he's a security guard as opposed to he's Steve Anderson, who lives down the road here on Route 43 or something like that, they get a pass. If you did that, if you or your son or something like that was walking through the woods and came up and threatened someone with a rifle, they would very likely, the local police would very likely respond to that.
Right.
And say, what's going on here? Don't you think you're going a little too far? But I don't understand why corporations get the pass that they do. Let's find out now what your thoughts are at this point. Where do you think this is going to go?
We were so encouraged when Dennis Kucinich came, and we had 100 people at that meeting to talk to him and tell him of our concerns and our worries, and it was really like a bright ray of sunshine. And when I talked to him on the phone, I said, you know, it's wonderful to have somebody on our side. So, and of course, my daughter lives here with me, and my granddaughter and her husband are building a new home up just up into the woods beyond my driveway. So I gave them 4 acres of land. And so they're concerned because if this goes into effect, and as I'm sure Bill McKeon mentioned, that if this goes into effect and they draw the water level down, property is not going to be worth anything. They told us once at a hearing in Nottingham that if our wells went dry, they would bring a tank of water to sit in our yard.
Oh, how pathetic.
For us to use. If we proved that it was their pumping that was decimating the water.
That's barbaric.
It is.
I mean, because there's a whole community that has lived in balance with its environment by sharing in a reasonable way.
Right.
And now they want you to change your lifestyle, that you become dependent on them, that they will bring you water. I'm sorry. I'm upset. I really am. I think that's absurd.
Well, you know, three of us, Bill McKeon and Marika Wild and I went to the radio station in Portsmouth. He talks noon times every day on the radio, and we had an hour there to explain our predicament and our case and our cause, and why we were so adamant about trying to get this whole project stopped. And it was really, really great because, unfortunately, a lot of people do not get the paper. Now, Foster's Daily Democrat is a paper that covers generally the whole county, and a lot of people do not get it except for the Sunday issue. And when I write my letters to the newspapers, I send them to all the newspapers I have emails for, and that includes Manchester and Concord and Portsmouth and Rochester and Dover. And trying to get the people aware of what will happen if this project goes through. And I know we did, SOG collected over 2,000 names on petitions, which we presented personally to DES, and this was probably around 2003, maybe 2004, of people who were opposed to this project. And then somebody will come across, or somebody from USA Springs will say, how can a few people hope to stop our project? And I don't consider that over 2,000 people in New Hampshire are opposed to this project. How they can figure that's a few people.
Well, it's all, they're playing the game as they've done this for years. I'm not saying USA Springs, I'm not going to say that, but I really refer to this as part of the extractive industries, which is a huge international conglomerate of interests that basically, you know, keep on just trespassing. It's a form of psychological, emotional, and spiritual trespassing that, you know, I think there's an interesting irony. But to me, it's a wake-up call and a warning.
Yeah.
That because what you're talking about is something that communities across America and literally around the world are facing, and that is the taking of their water.
Absolutely.
And so I think the concept of USA Springs is really the warning. In a larger scope, not just the corporation, but it is USA Springs that are a threat here.
Mm-hmm.
And if people lose their water...
That's
well,
right.
I recall reading a survival guide as a boy. There were a series of things that were most important to survival. The first was air. If your air is 1,000 degrees and you breathe it in, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't have air for 3 minutes, you're pretty much in crisis, okay?
Right.
But the second was water.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
And in terms of survival, it said, and food, you can go with 30 days without, really, you can actually survive for 30 days without food, but you can survive for 3 days without water, and then your whole body goes into crisis. Water is, we are water.
We are water, that's it.
Yeah.
And people So many people have no idea where their water comes from. Now, the rivers that are concerned in this particular area flow down into the Bellamy Reservoir in Dover, which supplies water to Dover and Portsmouth from this Bellamy Reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
And the gentleman who runs that news program at noontime that we went to had no idea where his water came from.
Right.
And most people don't. They turn the faucet on and there's the water. And they don't think a thing about it. And they don't know where it comes from. And when it's gone, then it's too late.
That is the issue that is confronting the world now as we talk about, as we hear stories about the future water wars.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear about the fact that certain communities in different parts of the world, based on global warming and other things, could face literal mass migrations because there just won't be water. Here you are, this is a 2007, and you're beginning to face this issue, and it's a very, very, very important issue, and I encourage anybody out there who may have an interest in helping your community survive this, and you personally, and as well as Save Our Groundwater and Neighborhood Guardians, to contact them and offer whatever assistance you can. For people who want to learn more or to help you out, what should they do?
Well, we have a website, and it is www.saveourgroundwater.org. And they can go to that website and find out our history and what we're doing and what we're trying to do.
Very good. Thank you so much. Now, on a very personal note, you mentioned that when you moved to your farm in March of 1960, there were 3 feet of snow on the ground. Now, that's a pretty serious snowfall. What's the trend been since then? Have you noticed, in terms of snowfall in winter, is it maintaining pretty much the same, or are you noticing a change?
This winter has been grotesque. We have had hardly any snow through November, December. We had snow in January, and then none, and then we have had more snow in April than we had all of November and December, and now we've had, I'm sure it's been on the news about the Northeaster. Where I am situated, I am lucky because I don't get flooded out, but a lot of New Hampshire has been flooded. People who rebuilt their homes last May, a year ago, have to start all over again this time. It seems to me that the whole time period is out of whack.
Well, some people like refer to it as global warming. I definitely think people need to think of it as global weirding. It isn't warming or cooling, it's weirding.
Mm-hmm.
And I expect that our weather situations will get stranger as time progresses.
I think so, and I do believe in the global warming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with all the pollution that the population of this planet is spewing into the air, it cannot help but to have an effect.
Patricia Newhall, you're a great voice for people. My heart goes out to you. I want to thank you so much for sharing your spirit here on the Wild Side News.
Yeah, that's what they call me. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Stand up for the earth, whether it be at a local produce stand or in your own front yard. It's not just the weather that's changing. Our whole world is changing. As a new order is forged, we can make a difference. Stand up for the earth. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth stands up for this earth, here on the Wild Side News.